So there's this scholar, teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, Bob Thurman. And I think he was in conversation maybe with a teacher from a different lineage. And he said, you know, you folks, all you talk about is practice. Practice, meditation practice, Dharma practice, 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 practice. When is the performance? And what is it, right? Now, in one sense, it is all practice. It's all. Our life is practice. We live in order to practice. But in another sense, there is a performance. We're not here to get good at following our breath. We're here to get good at living. And really where the rubber meets the road in our spiritual practice, our spiritual life, is in how we relate to other people. And so that's the topic for today, relating, relationship, love, sexuality, the whole mess. You know, when we practice, especially retreat, maybe do a lot of retreat, there's so many beautiful things that come up in the silence, and so many ways the heart is touched. But sometimes we can get a little carried away. We can maybe overvalue the insights and experiences and concentration, the samadhi, all the things that may arise. And I'm not dismissive of any of that. I spent a substantial proportion of my life in silence. But we can get kind of lost in that. And I think how we relate is a kind of beautiful mirror to see where our heart is free and where we can be freer. And of course, it's a source of incredible delight and also humility too. So one of my main teachers said, there are two maxims for spiritual practice. He's like, okay, if I had to summarize the last 40 years, you know, which is the time that he had been practicing, I would send you home with these two things. And we're like, get our notebooks out. Don't get your notebooks out. You don't have to take notes unless you want. But they're like, okay, what is it? And he said, don't fight with yourself at any level. And the second was take feedback. And that second one, that point about taking feedback, both highlights our imperfection and the impossibility of ever being utterly transparent to ourselves. And it also highlights the value of like learning from relationship. Now, we are relational beings in the sense that we only survive because of relationship. We're born into a state of like total dependence, you know, and our like very life depends on the goodwill of at least one other person. And so it makes sense that given this kind of conditioning, we would, the need to relate, to be a part of, to belong, is hypothesized to be like very fundamental. So one psychologist writes, it seems fair to conclude that human beings are fundamentally and pervasively motivated by a need to belong, and seem to need frequent, emotionally pleasant interactions with the same individuals. And they need these interactions to occur in the framework of long-term, stable caring and concern. So just like, you know, a lot of the pain in our hearts arose relationally, much of the healing also arises relationally. And it's not to diminish the role of solitary practice, of solitude, but there's a lot of healing that actually seems only to be done relationally. Stephen Levine, he said, you know, he's kind of like highlighting how our kind of like deepest habits are activated in relationships. And he said, your family pushes your buttons because they installed them. Right? And maybe you have this experience. My experience is like you know, when I've been single, I sort of feel like I've got my shit together. Like, yeah, good. Mental health, A-okay. Right? And then in relationship, I'm like, I've got issues. Right? And there's something about, you know, it's like when our neurosis doesn't have any roadblocks, you know, in the form of other humans, you know, it can just sort of go run its course, you know, and we actually don't see the clinging, right? But when we're relating, especially in kind of intimate romantic relationship, it's like it highlights all the places where we hold on. And so this is actually a gift to see, you know. The Buddha asks that we see clinging as clinging. And so we can notice in relating that it's like the craving and the aversion and the sort of contracted view of the self. All of that becomes more and more evident, and it's like maybe difficult but helpful to see. And so you add sexuality to the mix, and everything gets more complicated. The psychologist Adam Phillips, he said, at its best, relationship may be the wish to find someone to die with. At its worst, it is a cure for the terrors of aliveness. They are easily confused. Now, when we talk about the practice, we talk about, and Max has alluded to, especially this teaching on anicca, impermanence, and its connection to dukkha, to unsatisfactoriness. And, you know, some people feel like relationship is the answer to being single. And some people feel like being single is the answer to relationship. And what I want to suggest is that both are wrong. That there are ways that being in relationship can't resolve everything in the heart, and being out of it doesn't mean that we actually escape the momentum of certain kinds of clinging that are in our heart mind. Now, love and sexuality, like all of this is at the intersection of so many deep forces of belonging, of attachment, of desire, of all kind of so many evolutionary pressures, and the kind of Dharma themes that are in play are multiple. You know, it's like love and kindness, generosity, letting go, non-clinging, vulnerability, forgiveness, courage. And as Max alluded to yet last night, so many of the kind of the beautiful like gift of the heart, like to love is to like want to give or to share, whereas the clinging is to want to control in some way, and quite naturally they get tangled up. And part of our practice is distilling the love from the clinging. Now, the themes that we'll talk about, I am talking about, like they touch on maybe some very tender places. So, just be gentle as you hear this, as this resonates, like this. It's just tender terrain, I think, at some level for all of us. So I hope the comments are relevant for people in relationship, out of relationship, in love, in grief, in all the things that come. Rilke said, to love is good, love being difficult. For one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult of all our tasks, the ultimate, the last test and proof, the work for which all other work is but preparation. It seems like loving well, it calls on so much flexibility in the mind. And I don't know, some people seem to be kind of naturals, but I've always found it humbling. And I think I've found it humbling because there are times when I know I need to let go in one way or another, and I can't. And being like having some clarity of seeing whatever it is, like I know I want to let go. I want to let go of control, of view, a mood. I want to let go. And not being able to. This is very, you know, the heart, it's hard for the heart to stay open in the face of that, but it's important. Practice can help. Now, when we talk about these things, I you know, so often there are kind of cultural assumptions about heterosexuality, about monogamy, about having children, and so this whole, and I make none of these assumptions, and this whole realm is so laden with kind of cultural mores and views that seem like ultimately have no foundation, but shape our minds in powerful ways. So in the face of all this complexity, some people just turn away. And that's like a viable path, and it's asceticism, monasticism, you know. I was at a Buddhist teachers meeting, and it was at this like big, beautiful old Catholic monastery in this huge hall, and we had had a kind of very intense day, like very emotionally evocative and beautiful and painful. And that night there was like a dance. People staged a kind of impromptu dance. And I remember like we're all dancing and kind of laughing and like a lot of joy and just intense relating, you know? And I remember looking up at the balcony and I saw this very senior monk, Bhikkhu Bodhi, kind of wander out into the balcony. He's like monastic and celibate monk for many decades now. And I just remember him looking down at us dancing, you know. And it just kind of like highlighted the different paths, you know, different paths, how we're going to relate to sexuality and that whole realm. Now, the monastics have a point, insofar as sexual desire, that the realm is complicated, and while sex may be may be very kind of joyous, we can also look at sexual desire. And sex might be great, but sexual desire hurts. Max was alluding to this last night, just to desire in general. But like, sometimes we get focused on the object of gratification, on a particular experience, but we actually miss what it's like to desire, to be a body desiring. And it actually doesn't feel good. I had a friend who was on a month-long retreat, and on retreats, you know, as here, like there's a commitment to celibacy and to not masturbating and, you know, just to kind of like be careful with sexual energy. And as sometimes happens, he was just like besieged by sexual fantasy and desire. And it got to be like incredibly tormenting. And he like didn't want to break the commitment to celibacy and to not masturbate, but he was like describing the kind of like anguish of a few days. And desire is defined by lack. You know? Now, there's a question for me, like when we talk about distilling out the clinging from the love. In the realm of romantic relationship and sexuality, whether there's something inherently possessive about sexual relationship, whether there really is a way to relate fully, openly, with a kind of heartfelt commitment, and yet not cling. And I think these are people experiment with ways of doing that. And I don't know what the answer is. I'm sort of agnostic about it. But it does seem like in this realm, the clinging rises up so in like almost in unison with the love and sexual connection. So Stephen Mitchell, a psychoanalytic writer, he wrote, dependency is not a holdover from childhood. It is constitutive of desire for another person. And the vulnerability of dependency makes us feel endangered. In desire, we are endangered. And being endangered makes us angry. We want to control, to have the power to hurt the other whose charms have disrupted our equanimity, who has undermined our sense of self. That question of like, why can love devolve into aversion or hatred? Like, how does that happen? And I think part of it may be that we do feel endangered in desiring. There is that dependency is exquisite and offers the possibilities for very like magical connection, but it is a risk. It's a risk. To love is to risk. Now, I think in my mind, like a model of love, like a beautiful love, would be something like the union of Eros and Metta, of like alive, vital passion with the kind of tenderness and care and friendliness and I think nurturing that is complicated because this whole realm is so, there's so much projection and idealization, infatuation, there's so much mental proliferation around, you know? And it's almost like the person that we are interested in, or the person we're our partner, they can become like almost encased in projection. And so, I'm not sure I should share this. Maybe I'll share this line. You guys are already looking a little somber, and this line is devastating. This is from the French writer, psychoanalyst, Jacques Lacan, and who I can't understand much of what he writes, but anyway, and said something. He said, like, now I'm going to unpack this and rescue us from it, okay? But so, he said, love is giving something you don't have to someone who doesn't exist. So the way I read that is, giving to someone who doesn't exist means that there can be this way that the person is actually lost behind the layers of projection and the ways in which that person fits into our world, that and all of our ideas about them can actually obscure their being. And then to give something that we don't have. We can't be the end of seeking for anyone. And others cannot be the end of our seeking. Like that sense of of the kind of idea, fantasy that like that there is someone who can like be. I'm not being dismissive of like the beauty and power of love, but the sense that that person will satiate everything, every hunger and desire in us. Sets us up actually to resent the inevitable shortcomings. And in this tradition, like the end of seeking, others play a really important role, but the end of seeking only comes through our own heart cultivation. Amidst all of this, it is a place of such beautiful and deep practice. A couple teachers Kitty Sorrow and Tanisra, they were both monastics in different traditions for like 10 or 15 years, and they're celibate, and they met at some point. And they said something like, that it felt like an arranged marriage. They just didn't know who arranged it, you know. But they met, and it was just like, that's it. And so they left the monastic lineage and are still together after, a couple of decades now. And they're quite senior and beloved teachers, but they said that people most often want to ask them about their relationship. And I heard this story recounted that, like somebody said, what is it like to be practitioners sharing the Dharma deeply and then like living a life together? And Kitty Sorrow said, kind of like alluding back to the time of being in robes, he said, it's like having two people under one robe. When you practice as we are here or in robes, we take care of like all the joy and suffering that arises. And in relationship, that just kind of expands. The robe gets bigger. You share in a deeper way. Here's Stephen Mitchell again, alluding to a theme that we talk about often here, like opening to uncertainty, equanimity with uncertainty. Anicca, usually translated as impermanence, but sometimes as uncertainty. Yeah. And one teacher, Michelle McDonald, she said, like, anicca is the fact that things can be totally normal, and then one thing changes, and everything feels like it's changed. And that difference is just like always a possibility. This is uncertainty. And if we're to be deeply happy, the heart needs to come to peace with that. And so Mitchell writes, erotic passion destabilizes one's sense of self. When we find someone intensely arousing who makes possible unfamiliar experiences of ourselves, and an otherness we find captivating, we're drawn into disorientation. We tend to want to control these experiences and the others who inspire them. Sustaining romance requires a struggle to resist the efforts to draw moving but unsettling experiences under our control. Our journey in the otherness of the other often surprises us with unknown features of ourselves. Now, fully honoring the otherness of the other, like fully honoring them as a separate human being. Like not somebody who just like fits into our world. Like it's so easy to get, we kind of feel like the center of the universe, right? Like just the basic quality of the mind is that we, like our locus of concerns is like just the centerpiece, and naturally it's okay, right? But everything else can get kind of like plugged into that, to our world. And this, in a way, doesn't give the kind of freedom to the other. And so, psychiatrist Kernberg said, love is the revelation of the other person's freedom. Loves the revelation of the other person's freedom. Like, how much do we appreciate the freedom of the other? Now, this theme around aversion, aggression, it's like another field for our Dharma practice in the realm of relating, and that is to to negotiate our relationship with aggression. And in a sense, to make aggression safe for oneself and the other. Which maybe sounds like a paradox almost, like what's safe about aggression? But the image that I think of, like, you know when like tigers or lions are like sparring kind of, but it's friendly, but there's like some kind of aggression in it. It looks like it to me, but it's like everybody knows the rules, like nobody's really gonna get hurt. There's a kind of sanctity of the other. They're like not trying to do harm, but you're almost like playing with aggression. And the ability to feel safe amidst aggression, both like receiving anger and expressing it, that's a beautiful thing and a beautiful gift. Like to be open enough to receive it and to be able to share it in a way that is useful. There's an interesting finding, like there's a body of research on like what is associated with relationships staying together or breaking up. And so the researchers will like look at a bunch of couples at, you know, in 2016 and try to study them a bit, and then look in 2020 to see like, okay, who's still together, who split up. And one of the interesting findings is that it's not actually like the absence of issues or like difficult, maybe unresolvable arguments or differences. One of the like stronger predictors of staying together is actually being able to tap into some positive feeling amidst argument, right? So it's like the thread of connection to like love and care isn't lost amidst the differences. I remember my brother and sister-in-law had been married 6 or 7 years or so, and they don't fight often, but I was there with them. They were on vacation. I think we were all together, and they were like fighting about something, and at some point in this, it was like, you know, you sort of like didn't know which way was gonna, like, what's gonna happen, how this, it didn't feel like terrible, but it was like, this isn't good. And at some point during this, I'm kind of like sitting there a little bit like the innocent bystander. And my brother, I remember sitting on the couch, and his wife was sitting a few feet away, and, like there was like a pause in the argument, and my brother was sitting in such a way, he's like pretty little, but he was sitting in such a way that his like, he was kind of like hunched down and his belly was kind of like at its softest, right? And like kind of exposed. And she reached over in this like very sweet way, and she just like grabbed his belly and was like, "Donuts." And it wasn't like pretending that they weren't fighting or like, you know, just like you just reestablish the connection to love, you know. And our practice is like that. We like re-establish the connection to awareness, to love. Now, there's another characteristic. We talked a little about anicca, impermanence, and dukkha, suffering. But then there's anatta, not self. So this is from Shuangzu. The gender is male here. But, if a man's crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in the boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. If the shout is not heard, he will shout again and yet again and begin cursing. And all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if that boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not be angry. If you can empty your own boat crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you, seek to harm you. The practice that we're doing here we are emptying self-view. We are coming into a more flexible relationship with everything we think ourselves to be. We are draining the emotional charge from what we think makes us worthy and unworthy. We are letting go of the insistence on being this or being that, And in that process, we are freed up to relate in a very different way. Because our self-view, clinging to a particular self-view, only ever impinges love. We begin to empty the boat. And this is like it's like the mesh of our being gets wider and wider. And we naturally don't exert the same kind of egoic pressure on another person. In relationship or friendship or wherever it may be. Like, egos have a kind of like pressure. There's a certain like outward pressured force of ego. And it impacts everyone we encounter. And in the realm of love, it's especially problematic. No, none of this is incompatible with deep self-love and self-care and boundaries and dignity and the integrity of one's own body. It's not what's being pointed to here. But as we empty the boat, as we discharge more and more of the emotion from self-view, we become more and more flexible. Sometimes I think about my practice as like the aspiration is to become unoffendable, you know? Like to work through all the places of identification inside me so deeply that you could say anything and it's not going to land anywhere. It's not going to hit some tender point. And so much of the drama and pain of a relationship arises when it's like, we're offended. When something about the ego feels challenged. I'll just add that this teaching on anatta has relevance not just for emptying our own boat, but actually recognizing the emptiness of the other. We want to love the Atman. We want to love their self. We make them something. But we can love the emptiness of their self too. All of this can feel can feel like an adventure. A relationship can be adventure, like personal growth adventure. So this is from writer Ian Brown, who's talking about monogamy and sexual fidelity and the question of his own kind of musings about his desire for more than one partner. And so he says And he and his wife are talking. Yeah, it's at night, just laying in bed. He said, "We were having one of our gentle but ever so delicate chats about faithfulness when my wife said that the only thing she missed as a monogamous woman," at least I assume she was speaking as a monogamous woman, "was newness, new bodies, new hands, new sex." I said I knew what she meant, and I said, "But isn't that kind of sad? I mean, you go through your whole life, 20, 30, 40, 60 years of marriage without ever straying. You do that, you never get to know what it's like to be unfaithful. You never get to know what it feels like to be emotionally illegal. And that's an important feeling, one of the great human themes, after all, a whole constellation of humanity you'll never know." My wife was silent for a long time. And in the street light coming through the curtains, I could just see her outline. And I thought to myself, I've spent a long time in this bed. "Yes," my wife said then, "that's true. But if you do sleep around, you'll never know what it's like to be faithful to one person your whole life, which might also be a, quote, important constellation of humanity." There was just a touch of sarcasm in her voice. And then it was my turn to lie in the dark for a long time. I never considered monogamy as an adventure. I thought it was, well, domestic travel, where no international borders are crossed. But monogamy is an adventure, because trying to be faithful to one person is a trip that takes time, and you never really know if you're getting close or if you've reached the destination. You never really know when you've arrived. Now, for all the kind of beauty and healing and learning and redemption that we might find relating, the Dharma suggests that we never put all of our eggs in that one basket. And yeah, that we can actually take refuge in a love that's bigger than any relationship. That we actually don't privilege security over awareness. And so there is a sense of taking refuge in awareness. Settling into the quiet for a minute. Just holding yourself with some tenderness. Picking up whatever words might be of use and leaving everything else behind.